Collectors, let's talk about the real villain in your collection. It's not Dr. Doom, it's the dreaded box stack. You know the one, piles of sagging boxes, and the issue you need is always in the bottom box. When you lift, you pray your spine survives. If your comic boxes are stacked like a game of Jenga, it's time for Drawer Boxes, the easy access storage solution from CollectionDrawer.com. Drawer Boxes are stackable up to 6 high, but you don't have to unstack anything to get inside. Just slide out the drawer and you're opening a treasure chest of comic glory. And just like any file cabinet drawer, they'll hang open on the own while you peruse your collection, thanks to their patented box locks box anchors that secure each unit so that they won't tip. Worried about a drawer slipping out and dumping that near mint run of Ultimate Spider-Man on the floor? Not a chance, but their patented locking tabs that keep drawers securely locked into their shell until you're ready to remove them. Let's talk box sort upright dividers. They keep your comics standing tall, sorted by title, issue, era, whatever you like, and make it easy to file. No more leaning stacks causing spine cracks. So ditch the lifting, ditch the chaos. Drawer boxes turn your collection into a library, not a workout. Visit CollectionDrawer.com and start enjoying your collection today. Doesn't your first Deadpool appearance deserve better than being buried in a cardboard coffin?
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to Shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we've got a very special episode for you here, talking with the amazing Jamestown IV and Danny about the new title, Universal Monsters, Invisible Man number 1, out now from Skybound and Image Comics. Thank you so much for doing the podcast. Excited to chat about this.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, very excited, and James, excited to welcome you back to Universal Monsters. You kicked off this line with Dracula. I know you talked about this a little bit, but you had two things in mind which you wanted to do, this Dracula and Invisible Man. What was, that all being said, other than it being in your head and like kind of planning on doing it, what was different now on Invisible Man versus Dracula, other than obviously Danny on the art?
I mean, I think that, like, so, you know, like you said, when I was first told that Skybound had the Universal's license, the Universal Monsters license, I was basically like, at that moment, I had just walked away from superhero comics. I was done doing licensed books. And then Alex Antone said, we have this license. And I was like, damn it, I have to do this. And the two titles that I laid out were Dracula and the Invisible Man. Like, and like in that meeting at, you know, the full bar at San Diego Comic-Con, I was like, those are the two that you're not allowed to give to anyone else. Even though I, like, you know, I didn't really know how to approach them. But I mean, the Dracula, it's one of those things, the performances by Bela Lugosi and the actor who plays Renfield in that movie, whose name I'm blanking on at the moment. But like, those performances are incredible. And the visuals around those performances are incredible. But Dracula is like a 70-minute film that is not like, it's like iconic more than it's good. It like, it has all of these like really, really incredible performances in it and incredible moments. But it also like, it strips out a lot of the nuance of the original like Stoker novel and all that stuff. So it was one of those things that being able to bring a modern angle into that there was a huge opportunity there, especially with an iconic figure like Dracula. There were more ways in, I could see. Invisible Man was a lot more intimidating, pretty much from go, because the original James Whale film, I think, is like, you know, that and Bride of Frankenstein are the two best movies in the original Universal's franchise. Like, they are very, very smart. They are incredibly well written, well shot, and they tell complete stories. And, you know, this like, and the rules that I had set myself on Dracula, I wanted to carry forward into The Invisible Man here. I wanted to treat the films as continuity and not contradict them at all. So finding a way in to do something sophisticated that told a complete story, that danced around the moments in the original film, that was the challenge from go. And it was a really, really exciting challenge. And, you know, thankfully, I had such an incredible partner to bring this one to life. Danny is such a phenomenal artist and, like, has the, like, you know, we've worked together, like, briefly before, but this is the longest thing that we've done together. And it was just, like, I knew that Danny was going to bring the terrifying nature of Griffin to life on the page, and then also play with the incredible, like, Danny's work uses negative space incredibly, and this is a story that called for a lot of negative space.
I mean, that's what I wanted to ask you about first, actually, or Danny ask you about first, is your approach to invisibility. Having read the issue without getting too much into spoilers, like James is saying, you play with negative space, you play with shading a lot, sort of, there's a lot of like half faces in shadow, half faces in light that you're playing with as well. What was artistically the first thing you needed to crack, though? Was it that invisibility thing? Was it just the main character all the same time?
Yeah, I think the thing was with invisibility. We talked about it a bit, because okay, the one way to go was with the negative space, but some parts I wanted to show some things and show the invisibility. So we didn't follow a specific path. It was instinctively in each page, depending on what we want to show. We have used different approaches visually for the invisibility. So that was the thing to crack, I think. But it's more emotionally, at least for me, whenever I drew it and I chose how to do it, it was an emotional choice how to go. So I hope it makes sense when everyone reads it.
It does. Definitely also, makes sense. You know, for sure.
It was a great thing because also Brad Simpson, who is coloring it, really added into this, the part of the invisibility and how to make it special. So I think we've done a good job.
Well, talking about the emotionality of it, like, I feel like we're really riding with a monster here as he becomes a monster. And just from both the writing and art perspective, I think how do you make that palatable for us out here reading it and not feel like we're about to murder some friends of ours?
Because James is a true monster and he knows
how to write. There it is.
I do love writing a psychopath. And, you know, and I think that is the other thing that made me really excited to work on The Invisible Man, where, you know, the other universal monsters, they're the like archetypal evils like Dracula. And then there's these the more tragic monster like Frankenstein, who you really feel for over the course of the film. But Griffin is a very human monster because he is a psychopath, and he just like and people forget, but it's like the Invisible Man's kill count is like outpaces any of the other universal monsters just in that first film. Like when he does his reign of terror, he is he's killing a lot of people. And it is like, and unrepentantly. And it is one of those things where planting the seeds of like what makes him a monster was the challenge and the fun of this book. And we do want you to feel uncomfortable as this story goes on, because, you know, like the thing that made Griffin a monster is not the moment he turns invisible. The moment he turns invisible, it's kind of too late. He is.
Well, it's like handing him the weapon. He's already going to kill somebody. It's like, here you go. Yes. And it's very, especially in this first issue, it's very superhero origin. It's the most of them that feels that way. So it is like, or super villain, I should say.
Yeah. No, and I mean, like, it is that kind of, but that, like, those tropes are things that I really wanted to lean into here. He's a mad scientist. That is at the core of like who he is. And, you know, he's not like, you know, like Dr. Frankenstein. He is out to do bad things once he becomes invisible.
But one other thing that, and this is a very similar thing, but one other thing that I think separates him from the other Universal monsters is I always think of them as sort of romantic creatures in different ways. Yeah. Like Dracula, obviously, is seduction, but then Frankenstein, there's certainly a yearning going on there. Wolfman, same sort of thing, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't exactly seem to be present here. What happens when you take away that element? What makes him, I mean, this is kind of what we're talking about anyway, but what makes him different from these other monsters in that way?
I mean, I think that the romance of it and the illusion of romance and the way romance is like presented to the world is something that I was like very interested in playing with here, because one of the biggest difference between the Invisible Man film and the original H.G. Wells novel is how the character of Flora operates as his romantic interest in there. But you never see any moment of them together, because the movie starts with him already having transformed, and then she's just sort of pining for him like up until they're not really together until the very end of the film when he dies. And it's just like having like showing their romance and playing it in this kind of like cold way, where she doesn't really see him as, like, in the same, like, she doesn't really notice how messed up Griffin is. She just has the version of her life that she is trying to put together, that she sees where he would fit into that life, but she never looks at him directly. And that's what this opening sequence that Danny did so incredibly well, which happens in the snow, where it's just like they never really like lock eyes, where like, you know, Griffin's face is obscured, the snow is falling down between them, and they are just so separated, and she has the illusion of a romance and he has an illusion of a romance that is useful to him. And it's just like they're kind of using each other in a very human way, but yeah, it's that's it was really really fun to play with.
I just want to say real quick. I just wanted to mention, Daddy, you have some fantastic horror movie lighting going on, by the way. I'm really enjoying it.
Yes, you live this lifestyle.
It's a really bad lighting, but that's what
No, it's great.
No, like the it's red gotten, we've been talking cool. for like 10 minutes. It's gotten fully dark.
Yes, I'm outdoors. Sorry.
No, it's great. I love it. I did want to ask you, like, on a similar sort of lighting thing, though, and again, mild spoilers, but the most, I wouldn't say scary, but most disturbing part of the first issue to me is not anything with the invisibility. It's the scene where he's eating meat at dinner. And I was curious to hear, Daddy, first you talk about from the artistic perspective, and James, maybe from the script perspective, what went into crafting that scene, because the way that it plays out is so intricate and careful, and the little splashes of red coming out of the lips, it's pretty gross.
But that's the thing with James' scripts. First of all, I feel lucky that I got to read them. And boohoo, you cannot. No, okay, you can. But it was the way he artistically, and trying to put this visually on the page, was that he described certain emotions during the scenes, and his description that I was just trying to pass this atmosphere that he created on the script. And with Flora also, the romantic thing that James said earlier is that it's this coldness. And when I was reading how James wrote Griffin's character, it was a bit like a sadist also. Yeah. Cold heart, egomaniac, but really intriguing. So this is what I tried to depict with the shadows and everything. And also James suggested that we never showed his face properly. It was all that he would always be a bit obscured or a horror setting. Yeah. I don't know, with shadows. So I think this adds, yeah, in the whole thing, in the whole book also.
Oh, go ahead, James.
There's one beat, like, and it happens in the first issue where, like, Griffin says something earnestly to Dr. Cranley. And it's the one time in the issue that his face is unshadowed. And he basically puts himself out there and says what he truly wants and he truly thinks and feels. And then he withdraws immediately and is embarrassed for having actually put himself out there and been seen. And that, like that, that was why, like, being working with an enormous talent like Danny, like, knowing that, like, though that moment would read with the power that it needed to, with the way that he is obscured and continues to be obscured over the course of this series, like, is, I don't know, I'm enormously proud of this book.
Go ahead, Justin.
You go.
James, I was going to ask you, this is a little bit off, but I am going to loop it back to Universal Monsters. At San Diego Comic-Con, you announced that Something is Killing the Children is running at least 100 issues, which, if you guys keep up the current pace, should take you to about 2035 or so. That's a pretty big commitment and a pretty long commitment. I'm just curious, in a broad sense, you have that as sort of like a checking in point, I assume, every once in a while, but how do you balance things like that going on for the next decade alongside miniseries like this and everything else that you're doing?
I mean, it could be, you know, like, it can be a struggle sometimes, but it is a, you know, the nice thing that can be, that can sometimes be fleeting in comics is, like, for many years working in the comics industry, I didn't know what I was working on next year. So you always had to be chasing, like, three or four things at any given moment that then there's sometimes all four of them would end up happening. And then you don't sleep for 6 months. Or, like, suddenly, you know, only one of them comes through. They come through in different orders. There are so many different ways that things come to life. The thing that makes me excited about that kind of commitment that Boom was able to make for the series is just, like, I know how many issues of Something is Killing the Children I'm going to be writing per year, and I can build the rest of my schedule around that assurance. And then especially now that Boom is, like, a part of the larger entity Penguin Random House, it's just like, you know, the largest publisher in the world has guaranteed that this issue series will run 100 issues. Now that's not in question. Like, so it's just like, I can, you know, I can move ahead. And, you know, and then when I take little moments to step outside of my own original work into, like, other people's universes, like, you know, I did here with Invisible Man, it can be this, like, nice focused work. It can be, I can just make sure I can just focus on the artistry because each of these projects only exists because I want to do them, not because, like, I have to do them. Yeah.
So that's how you balance schedule wise. How do you balance the the darkness, the creation side of it, so you're not constantly mining the worst possible thing for both of you as a writer and artist? What are your breaks?
I mean, I think that I try to make sure that it's like I'm living a human life and I'm, like, hanging out with friends and, like, doing all of it. But it is I like working in horror because it actually allows me to work through and work out a lot of, like, my darkest human emotions and just sort of let them out onto the page so then I don't carry them with me in my, like, day to day human life. You know, like, horror is deeply personal and deeply expressive, and it's my favorite genre to work in. I like getting the ugly stuff out so then, I can have a nice, pleasant personal life.
So you're not trying out chemical injections in?
No, I'm not.
Nice. Well, I don't know what you mean. I have dark emotions all the time. I just keep on keeping them. I don't give them away. Yeah. Wow.
We're going to have to let you go in a second, but I did want to ask James, now that you've done Dracula and Invisible Man, and Danny, now that you've done Invisible Man, do you feel like you have another Universal monster in you, or potentially some sort of Abbott and Costello style mashup of all the monsters coming together?
I think there a lot of people are asking this question, and it's one that it's like it's whenever I meet up with Alex Antone, whenever I'm chatting with like Michael Walsh, who did the Frankenstein series, like there's always a little bit of chatter of like, what would that even look like? And that chatter has definitely happened and happening. But right now, like the Invisible Man was the last licensed thing on my plate for a little while. And so I'm very happy for it to live as what it is. But I know that they have incredible plans for the Universal Monsters line, in the years to come.
Classic 360 shot from Avengers with all of them gathered together being like, huh? Hell.
Yeah. For both of you, congratulations on the book. It's absolutely fantastic. Really looking forward to checking out the rest of the issues. And Danny, get somewhere safe, okay?
Yeah, please. Turn on a flashlight.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.